This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch Potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Kingsman, The Golden Circle, Friend Request, The Lego Ninjago Movie, The Trip to Spain, and Little Evil. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup featuring Wonder Woman. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. Or if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I missed Harry Dean Stanton's passing last week. What didn't talk about on the show. Just wanted to hit that really quickly. He was 91. One of the things about him that was so indelible as an actor is he was not like the lead actor. He was always a secondary character or supporting role. I mean, there's a couple of them where he played a main character, but he was this character actor that appeared in a lot of just regular mainstream stuff, but he was also in some amazing genre pieces. Like, he played one of the characters in Alien. He was in Red Dawn, the original Red Dawn, the whole Avenge Me thing. You even saw him have a little tiny little cameo in the first Avengers movie. He was actually in the TV broadcast, I believe, of, I think it was The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. One of those top three spaghetti westerns where they kind of had an introduction and they had him playing a version of Blondie where you never saw his face, but he was kind of an on-screen character, which is kind of fascinating because he doesn't look anything like Clint Eastwood. But Harry Dean Stanton was one of those guys. It was just always kind of warm and fuzzy to just watch him show up on screen because he kind of was like everybody's haggard old uncle. You know, he kept just showing up in movies. He's got a couple movies coming out still. So he worked till the very end. Also, rest in peace to Bernie Casey, Columbus, Ohio native. Well, I guess he wasn't born in Ohio. I think he was born in West Virginia. He grew up in Columbus, Ohio, which is my hometown. Went to Bowling Green, which is my alma mater. And he went on to become a football star, but he also did a lot of stuff with acting and the arts. And I mean, a lot of people will remember him, sort of like probably the highest level role he had was in Revenge of the Nerds. He played the Lambda head. I think Ewan Jefferson was his name. And for me, I remember him seeing him in stuff like The Martian Chronicles, that when that was on TV back in the 70s, or even when he was in Never Say Never Again, which is a lousy Bond movie. But he played Felix Leiter in that version of James Bond, in that sort of non-canonical version of the James Bond series. Bernie Casey was a legend, and he was 78 when he passed. Again, sad to see both him and Harry Dean Stanton go. The one piece of news that's really been swirling around, and I have to apologize because I have yet not seen Mother. I was on vacation last week, so I missed some of the films. I went up to Alaska for a cruise. Great, beautiful time, actually. But when Mother came out, it made a lot of noise because, not because it did well at the box office, but rather because it got an F cinema score. Now, for those who don't understand how this works, cinema score is done by a company where they basically interview people coming out of movies. And those numbers are always going to be skewed. If you look at cinema scores, most movies get an A in somewhere, maybe an A minus, maybe a B. But those scores tend to skew really high. And the reason for that is because it judges people who've paid to go see a movie. And most people will only pay to go see a movie that they're at least interested in. And that doesn't mean you're going to like it, but you're going to be predisposed to like it. For example, if you don't like romantic comedies, you're not going to pay to go see a romantic comedy. If you don't like superhero movies, you're not going to pay to see the latest Justice League or Marvel superhero movie. And that's why you see films like the Transformers movies, which are garbage, tend to get really high scores because the only people who are going to go see Transformers, especially when you get to like Transformers 4 or 5, the only people who are going to go see that are people who are predisposed to like it. And occasionally you get these movies get F cinema scores. And they kind of make a lot of noise because it's kind of rare. I think there's only been 19 movies in the last 30 years or however long they've been keeping track of this. And some of them are just bona fide terrible movies. Like, I Know Who Killed Me, which was this movie with Lindsay Lohan about 10 years ago. That's a garbage movie. It's a terrible film. Nobody liked it. It doesn't speak to an audience, whether they advertise to them or not. That one completely deserves an F Cinema score. But sometimes you'll see movies get an F Cinema score, or even sometimes a lower Cinema score, when they're marketed as something they're not. A great example is this, earlier this year you had It Comes at Night was marketed as a Monster in the Woods story. And it wasn't about that. It was about more of a paranoia of people kind of resisting a plague in a house. Very different than how they were marketing it. So anybody who was interested in seeing a movie like that went to go see a movie expecting to see a monster movie and they didn't get it, so they were disappointed. And anybody who wanted to see the more paranoid version didn't go see it because they thought it was going to be a monster movie. Or like The Witch a couple of years ago got a really low cinema score. It wasn't an F, but it was a low score because it wasn't a mainstream movie. And supposedly, Mother, it was billed. I mean, actually, the trailers were kind of intriguing as a sort of this thriller horror movie. And that's not what the movie is. Part of that's mismarketing. I think part of it's also, it's Darren Aronofsky. Darren Aronofsky's never been mainstream. The closest he got was like Noah, which was kind of a flop. Or Black Swan, which was an award season favorite, but it wasn't a general horror movie. And I think they're really pushing Mother to be a horror movie in the advertising, and it wasn't that. So people tend to get very fickle, so they get paid money to see a horror movie, and I saw a boring drama. And then on top of it, it's Darren Aronofsky, who's not mainstream at all. He's very art house. That's going to contribute to a low cinema score. There's been a lot of news lately about cinema score and Rotten Tomatoes and shaming anybody who reviews a movie, blaming them for the movie's failure. No, if you got a crappy movie like Baywatch, which had a terrible Rotten Tomatoes score and it was a terrible movie and it bombed. Yeah, that happens because it was a bad movie. I don't think people stayed away from Baywatch because it got bad reviews or bad cinema score. I think people just stayed away because it looked like a terrible movie. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to hit is Tomb Raider. Opens on March 16th.
Lara, your father's gone. You can pick up where he left off.
Hello, Sprout. If you're listening to this, then I must be dead. I found something. A tomb called the Mother of Death. If Trinity succeeds, our world is in danger. Promise me you will stop them.
This one stars Alicia Vikander, and it made a lot of news because they recast it, because it was originally Angelina Jolie, like, what, 15 years ago when they started making these movies. And what's funny is you look at this, they kind of said, okay, we're not going to give her a absurdly large breasts in this movie, which they kind of did with Angelina Jolie, who was already sort of top-heavy, but apparently they padded her chest out in that film. This one's just going for straight-up adventure. I don't know. I'm not quite sold on it. It looks like it could be just run-of-the-mill garbage, but it also looks like it could be fun. It just depends on what the story is. I mean, yeah, Lisa Vikander looks great. It's just, I get no sense of story. I get no sense of the scope of the action. It looks like it might be overly CGI'd. It may not kind of fit together. It may feel like it's a movie that's meant to be in March, as opposed to something like Kong Skull Island, which was a great movie in March that really felt like it could have been a summer blockbuster. The next one I want to talk about is Isle of Dogs, opening on March 23rd.
Atari Kobayashi, you heroically hijacked a junior turboprop XJ-750.
Minute!
And flew it to the island because of your dog.
Darn it.
I've got a crush on you.
Spots, if he's alive, may very well be living even at this moment as a captive prisoner.
Will you help him? The little pilot.
Why should I?
Because he's a 12-year-old boy. Dogs love those.
This is Wes Anderson's newest film. I love Wes Anderson. I know I fall into that art house nerdiness with that. And this goes back to the stop-motion animation he used with Fantastic Mr. Fox. But this just looks so clever and really has a unique-looking story. This does not look like it's spinning off of anything at all. And if anything, people have complained about it is we don't get enough original stories, and this is looks like it's going to be original. It doesn't bother me it's coming out in March. He's done this before, and heck, he won awards with the Grand Budapest Hotel, which was like a summer release, and it stayed around through award season. So I'm certainly looking forward to Isle of Dogs. I can't wait for it. I love Wes Anderson. And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Lego Ninjago movie and the trip to Spain. Because we can, can! Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Everything is cool when you're part of the team. Everything is awesome. Living our dream. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's start talking about the movies that I'm reviewing this week. Well, one of them, the first one I'm not actually reviewing because they didn't screen it, which is odd, actually. I mean, it's Warner Brothers, and they sent me a neat little Lego Ninjago thing, which I haven't put together yet because I'm like, oh my God, I don't have time to do this. But it's a little piece, so I got to put that together and send a picture of that out. But, you know, they promoted this movie. It's all over the social media. It's all over the cartoon channels. It's all over regular channels. I remember they really pushed it back during the Batman Lego movie. But somehow this just kind of, the rug got pulled out from under it. Well, let's just go ahead and play the trailer, and we'll talk about it here in a second. In the Lego Ninjago movie, a young man faces off against his evil father, who wants to conquer the world of Ninjago.
All right, guys, let's get Garmadon!
Where did that come from?
Hello, Dad.
Lloyd?
That's right, and it's Lloyd, Dad.
It's okay, Lloyd. Nobody's parents are perfect.
Yeah, but I feel like there's more to Garmadon that I need to know.
To understand your future, you must go back to your ninja roots. Your dad was a ninja too. Are you ready to risk your life for Ninjago?
Ninjago!
If I were to guess as to why Warner Brothers limited the screenings of this, part of it is that it actually is kind of getting middling reviews. It's last I checked, it was in the 40s percentage-wise on Rotten Tomatoes, and now everybody's like all triggered about Rotten Tomatoes. Oh my gosh, here's the thing. When it comes to controlling like a Rotten Tomato score, you can't control it. Because even if you withhold reviews, as soon as Thursday night and Friday hit, all the reviewers are going to go see it. They're going to publish their reviews and boom, you're going to get a Rotten Tomato score. You might get an evening of people not knowing. But the fact that you're holding reviews just shows that you are afraid of the reviews. There's no way around it. There's no way to manipulate this, and it's infuriating studios, and it's making like Warner Brothers do stupid things with this movie. This should have been screened widely. There was a screening in Columbus. I heard about it. I was actually invited by the online processing as just a regular person, but it was pulled from the critic screening list. I wouldn't have been able to see it anyways. I was in Alaska, but it suddenly got pulled from the screenings. For whatever reason, Warner Brothers suddenly is like, oh, well, we're going to screen it. Let me tell you something. It made over $100 million its opening weekend, not because you screened it. It made over $100 million because it was a good movie and it did what it needed to do. The good reviews certainly helped it, but it was getting buzz anyways long before reviews, long before you had a Rotten Tomato score. And the Rotten Tomato score isn't what drove people to see it. It's just a reflection of the acceptance of the movie. But no, the Lego Ninjago movie was not screened. It's promoted. And I never quite understand that. I never understand why studios will promote things and send out stuff and but then, oh, wait, we don't want you to actually see the movie. I have, not with Warner Brothers, but I have literally been approached for interviews and promotional information and trailer placements and people, oh, can you talk about our movie? And I'm like, can I see it? And like, no. You want to pay me a fee? Advertise on the show. But I'm not going to just promote your movie for you. If you want to show me your movie, show me your movie. And at the very least, I'm going to talk about it. I'm easy on this stuff. I've watched some of the Lego Ninjago stuff. My kid watches it on Netflix. I think the Lego stuff is fun. It's cute. It's irreverent. It's silly. And, you know, is this going to be a monster hit like the Lego movie? No, because Ninjago's in a very limited market. It's something that only little kids watch. It's not like Batman. At least Batman, everybody knows who Batman is. the Batman Lego movie was just another Batman movie, and it was silly and fun. And the Lego movie kind of hit that pop culture zeitgeist where it had all the different things. It could deal with anything. And everyone's played with Legos, you know, going up to people in their 50s. So I'm all for these Lego movies, but I'm just flummoxed by why they didn't screen it. And so, I mean, I have, and then they didn't even show it on Thursday nights. I couldn't even go see it on a Thursday night. So it just gets a preemptive suck. Sorry.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the trip to Spain. Steve Coogan and Rob Brighton reprise their roles as exaggerated versions of themselves as they spar over a series of dinners in a trip across Spain.
Rob, Steve Coogan. Just got back from filming in New York.
They want me to do publicity.
A series of restaurant reviews. This time, a trip to Spain.
Yes, I will come.
The thing about doing more.
Yes?
Less is more.
Ah, you've met my brother Les.
Come, come, Mr. Bond. You enjoy the scallop just as much as I do.
Bottoms up.
Goodbye, Mr. Bond.
This is the third movie in this series. I covered a trip to Italy a couple years ago when it came out. And I find these movies very, very charming. I think the first one they did was the trip, and I think it was either in France or England. And then they did a trip to Italy, which has had them doing basically restaurant reviews. They're really made for the fans of these guys. Steve Coogan and Rob Brighton are these basic British comedians, and they play these versions of themselves, which are sort of like self-deprecating, over-exaggerated versions of who they sort of see themselves out. This one follows up Philomena, which was a movie that Steve Coogan was starred in, and he helped write, and of course it got Oscar nominations. And so he can't stop talking about Philomena. So it's him being very self-centered and egotistical. But really, this is just a chance for these two comedians to just riff off each other and spar and go back and forth. And that's fun to watch. There's no real plot to them. They will put like a limp plot where, like in this one, Rob Brighton, his character has kids and he's sort of taking a time to go away and reappreciate his family. Whereas in the previous one, it was him kind of having a couple affairs along the way. In this one, he's being a little more monogamous. Steve Coogan's more of the absurd buffoon in this one, where he's dealing with his estranged family, which he's done in the past, but also dealing with sort of coming to terms with his own success that is making it a challenge for him to do things. But ultimately, like I said, the reason to see this movie is to watch two very dry, masterful British comedians improv, just do crazy stuff at dinners around a place in Europe. And like I said, the original trip is a little bit gloomier, a little bit darker. And I believe that at one point was available on Netflix. The trip to Italy was a little lighter, a little bit more funny. This one gets a little darker because now we're getting into them. I think like Steve Coogan's turning 50. And so they're really facing their mortality as opposed to guys in their 40s having a midlife crisis, which is what happened in the previous film. And like I said, ultimately, it's whether or not you like these guys. And this is not the first time Steve Coogan's kind of played an exaggerated version of himself. He did this in these other two movies, of course, but he also did, with Rob Brighton, Tristan Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story, which was out, oh gosh, that was almost 10, 15 years ago, where it was them trying to make a movie that is allegedly unfilmable. And he played an exaggerated version of himself, kind of this crazy, unhinged version of himself that became less about the story they were making and more about a self-deprecating look at him. And that's sort of Steve Coogan's wheelhouse. I mean, a lot of people recognize him for stuff like Night at the Museum in America, but he's very much a well-sought-out comedian in Britain. And if you've seen these movies or stuff like the Alan Partridge radio series, which then spun off into its own movie, you'll appreciate this. I enjoy this. So I'm going to have to say, just because I enjoy these movies, the trip to Spain kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Kingsman, The Golden Circle, and Friend Request. Let the sky fall. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews of more films that I've actually seen. The first one is Kingsman: The Golden Circle. In this over-the-top sequel, the Kingsmen are attacked, so the survivors partner with their American counterparts to take down an international drug dealer.
We're from the Kingsman Tailor's Shop in London. Maybe you've heard of us?
Today marks the beginning of a new age. Say goodbye to the Kingsmen.
Kind of got a bit of a save the world situation here.
Welcome to Statesman.
As your American cousins, we'll be working side by side.
Let's get started.
It's very American.
Yeah, it is.
I remember when the first Kingsman came out, it actually was kind of the surprise hit. I mean, it was tracking well, but then it came out and it did extremely well in the theaters. When it came to my personal views of it, I thought it was fun. I thought it had some interesting elements to it. The part that people seem to focus on as being the greatest scene in the movie, I was not a fan of. The greatest scene in the movie that everybody always says is when Colin Firth's character goes completely bonkers and insane and kills all these people in this basically white supremacist church. And I get the adoration for the scene. I mean, it is a bit of a mastery of action and fighting and all this sort of special effects, one take shot type thing. But it just went on way too long. It just kept going and going. And it got brutal and like overly violent. And I thought it was kind of this cheap shot because what he was doing was really horrible. But because he was doing it to white supremacists, that's okay. And I'm like, not a defense of white supremacists. It's just, I'm like, you're loving the violence and you're just kind of excusing the violence at that point. Cause let's put deplorable people in there and that he's fighting against and then it's okay. You know what I mean? And it's not even in a war situation. Like, you know, I'm talking about Wonder Woman later when she's out there fighting the Germans in the no man's land field. That's warfare. But this one was, it just went a little over the top and it went a little bit crazy. And I thought it got crass at times, especially there's a bit at the end and they kind of make reference to the joke again in this one that I thought was really overly misogynistic for as much as it's trying to send up James Bond movies. It got incredibly misogynistic and almost really sleazy at the end in one aspect. But overall, it still was a fun movie. Now, this movie it's a sequel. And like any sequel you're going to see, it goes farther. It goes crazier. It goes more intense. Whereas the first movie, it had action and it was a punchy kind of fun movie, but it took time to ramp up to the crazy stuff. This one hits it in the first scene. I mean, literally the first scene feels like they're trying to top the church scene in the first film. And I get the point of that, but that is a level of energy that is very hard to keep up for 2 hours and 20 minutes. It's also a 2 hour, 20 minute movie. So it runs too long. And there's really nowhere to go beyond that. Once they hit that kind of crazy, insane, hyper real, impossible, absurd action, where do you go from there? It hits 0 to 60 in a car that can only go about 70. So at that point, you're just like, well, you've done that in the first 5 minutes. I mean, how do we go bigger? And it tries to rev that engine full speed constantly. The other thing with it is it does something that sequels do where kills a bunch of other people. So puts them on his own, which it makes an interesting movie, but it doesn't do very much for the sustainability of the franchise. And I've never been a big fan of franchises that say, well, we need to up the ante, so we're just going to kill all these people from the first one. And I thought that was kind of lame. But there's still some fun stuff to it. I mean, the action is fun. It's got some good humor to it. I didn't find this one to be as misogynistic or as glorifying the graphic violence as much as the first one was. I actually think they spread it around a little bit. And the action scenes are fun, but it does run a bit long. The other thing with this movie that I really enjoyed were the performances of Julianne Moore as the international drug lord. She's basically taking over Samuel L. Jackson's role from the first film, where he was this over-the-top international villain. And I just find her just fun to watch. She's not terribly well-developed. It's just fun to watch her act. I think she's kind of a joy to watch in this movie. And that says a lot to her. And I like the fact that she can still do goofy, silly game projects like this without being, oh, I'm an award-winning actor or anything like that. The other great performance in this movie is by Elton John, who starts off as just a cameo, and it turns into a really funny bit with him. They really kind of hit a balance with him in this role. He's game enough to do some silly things and make fun of himself and make fun of his image and make fun of what he's meant in the past, but also it gives him a chance to actually do some other things. And I mean, there's portions of the movie that just go so far and too absurd. If there's any real problem, it's that it goes too absurd at times. But that's the silly fun stuff is what I liked about it, not when it's trying to be a little more serious, because it has a back ends a story about drug use and the legalization of drugs and the excusing of drug use. I mean, it gets a little bit annoyingly political at times, kind of like that movie Machete that Robert Rodriguez did, where you're just like, oh wait, you're now turning an exploitation movie into trying to make a coherent political point, and that just doesn't work. But you know, for sort of like a throwaway September movie, I'm gonna have to say it still kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Friend Request. A college student befriends a loner online, only to find out she's the target of violence after the girl kills herself.
Fellow students, Marina Mills committed suicide.
It was a nice video you posted.
I'm not posting any of this.
I don't think this was a suicide. I think it was a ritual. This is how witches got revenge on people. Possessing them, haunting them, killing them.
There's a lot of movies that this reminds me of, and I've been referenced to. Like the most obvious one to me is Single White Female, which came out about 25 years ago. That one had Jennifer Jason Leigh and Bridget Fonda in it, and that was before social media, but it was basically the loner girl having an obsession with somebody and then kind of going bonkers. This one takes it a little more occultish because, you know, when she kills herself, there's supposedly witchcraft involved. But it's essentially a unpopular girl friending a popular girl, becoming obsessed with her, and then is seeking to harm her. This also reminds me a little bit of that movie Unfriended that came out, which is a very different movie because Unfriended was that sort of found footage all done on a Skype chat. But this one is more just about the dangers of social media. And what's weird is it has this weird thing where it actually passes the Bechdel test to the point that if you switch it around and you make the Bechdel test about men, it fails that. All the characters, main characters are women, and then the guys are just eye candy in supporting roles. Which is funny because it gives you a chance to look at it and go, why do they even have this guy in here? Just get rid of the character. It's not that I'm like offended that he's a marginalized character. I'm just like, well, he's unimportant. Let's just get rid of him. But I couldn't shake the feeling as I watched this that this felt like somebody in their 50s scolding teenagers about the dangers of social media. And ultimately, the real victim in this movie aren't the people that get killed or hurt. It's her social status. I mean, they haven't even watched the trailer. They're like, oh, she has 800 friends. Then she has 500 friends. Then, she's losing friends. It's so aggressively about social media, but doesn't quite understand how social media works, especially social media about this age. I know kids because I got teenagers. I'm aware of what they do. And there's almost a rejection going on of too much social media, that social media is just there as a scrapbook, but they don't live their lives in social media. It's almost like the parents that think they live their lives in social media. It feels like, somebody from the 50s being lectured about listening to too much rock and roll and the dangers of juvenile delinquency. And I watch this movie where they're trying to say, oh, well, look how bad social media is and the addiction to social media. I'm like, I heard all that in the 80s when I was a teenager about MTV. So it's always an older generation not accepting and saying, oh, this is really dangerous, which this is not how teenagers and 20-somethings really deal with social media, but it just feels like it's a 50-year-old's version of that. And ultimately, the story does break down about halfway through and never recovers. So, you know, they screened it, so I give them credit for it. But ultimately, I do have to say the friend request kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Little Evil, the weekly box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Wonder Woman. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue with the final movie review, and that is a Netflix original movie. It's been actually out on the service for a little bit, so it gives people a chance to see it. I wanted to cover it partly because it's it swerves into horror, and we're getting ready for October, so why not? Let's talk about Little Evil. In this Netflix original movie, Adam Scott plays a man who suspects his new stepson is literally the Antichrist.
My wife and I just recently got married. She's perfect. She's everything I ever wanted. And, you know, I'm having a little tiny bit of trouble bonding with my new stepson, Lucas. He never really looks me in the eye. Doesn't talk much, except when he yells at me to get out of his room. Get out! Using this weird little goat puppet thing. I get this sense that he's,
That he's evil incarnate.
Yeah.
There have been multiple movies that have been made about sort of like the sort of Omen type spinoff. And they've done spoofs of Exorcist and Omens and Evil Children. I remember going back to Repossessed in the 90s with Leslie Nielsen. What first drew me to it was Adam Scott. I think he's very funny. And going all the way back with it, he actually has a horror movie background. He was in one of the Hellraiser movies back in the day, like Hellraiser Bloodline, where it was the one that took place in like the 1700s and on a spaceship. But I kind of wanted to see what he did with this because I like his sort of dry delivery. He's one of those dry American comedians. The idea is clever enough. The problem with this movie is while it has a pretty funny setup where, you know, this kid's clearly an evil child. He's a dead ringer for Damien in The Omen. You know, he's clearly this demonically possessed child. But of course, his mother, Evangeline Lilly's character, she, of course, forgives him for everything. And we've all known people like that. We've all known people who've been horrible children who the parents think they're just angels. And while the setup works, there's a turn that has to happen in comedies. And this is the difference between a sketch and a feature length movie. At a certain point, you have to propel the story. At a certain point, you have to have a goal for the characters to achieve, and you have to get them to grow in some way. You got to have some sort of character arc. And that's a real challenge for some movies to get past. I remember when the movie The Invention of Lying came out by Ricky Gervais, which is a great setup, and then it just didn't know what to do. And it kind of goes crazy Ricky Gervais atheism route, which didn't quite work in that movie. And this one's sort of the same way, where it has this great setup, and then it tries to put the characters into a proper position of a character arc, and it just doesn't quite work. It in trying to put heart in this movie, it just doesn't work. And when the movie tries to have a character arc and a process in terms of a more traditional storytelling, it does fall apart. It feels very much like a made-for-TV movie, which, if I remember a couple weeks ago, I talked about Death Note, which I enjoyed for what it was, but these Netflix original movies, they still kind of feel like direct-to-video movies. And that's essentially what I think Netflix is doing. They're making a lot of movies, but a lot of the movies that I've seen don't feel like they're theater potential, where something like Mystery Science Theater fits in the Netflix realm. Like the series, the television series work better for Netflix. The Netflix original movies feel like something that was direct to Showtime back in the 90s. So while Little Evil has some funny moments, I'm still going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. I didn't really talk about this much last week, but let's acknowledge how awesome it has been in the box office. The budget for this movie is $35 million. The opening weekend, it made almost $125 million. It made more than three times its budget in the first weekend. That is unheard of for any movie that's but even then, a $35 million budget, that's great to do on a $35 million budget. It's one thing when some Blumhouse movie costs $4 million to make and it makes $12 million, and you're like, oh, that's three times its budget, and that's good. But this $35 million, it is a monster hit, pun completely intended. But then the next week, you had it coming in with $60 million. People were predicting $60 million its first weekend. That is how huge of a hit it was. And even last weekend, you had American Assassin, which is about $15 million. That's not bad for that kind of movie. Mother was only 7.5. Also, I think that's going to drop like a stone with the cinema score and the fact that it's gotten so much news as not being what it's advertised. It has been unstoppable, and it is responsible for the massive numbers of box office that we're having in September. No other movie, aside from it, is the reason, because it broke the box office record for September by a mile, and that's what's boosting the September box. You take it out of the equation, and you have kind of a stinker month. Now, this week, I think you're going to get it getting dropped off. I think Kingsman's probably going to beat it this week, and that's completely fine. I mean, Kingsman, people are predicting $45 million or more. I don't know if it's going to be as strong because it's getting some middling reviews for the fans of the original movie. I don't know if it's going to have that same boost that the first one. I think people are hedging the bets. They're hoping that it's going to do a 22 Jump Street. Whereas if it just matches the first one, 35 to 40 million, I think it's going to be a success. But I think there's also a lot of competition out there, especially R-rated competition with it still in the theater. It's probably going to be about $30 million or more. Lego Ninjago, I think the good thing that has is that it's working in a vacuum of children's movies. So I think that the Lego Ninjago movie is going to do well enough just because there's nothing really out there for kids. But I don't think it's going to do as well simply because it doesn't have the awareness that Batman or the original Lego movie does. So I think both Kingsman and Lego will underperform, and it's going to be still holding pretty well with $30 million or more. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on Wonder Woman, which came out this week. Gal Gadot plays the iconic superhero from DC Comics as she leaves her protected island home to fight in World War I.
What is this place? Who are you?
It is our sacred duty to defend the world.
Right. Whoever you are in more danger than you think.
Be careful, Diana. If no one else will defend the world, then I must.
What are you?
I am Diana of Themyscira, daughter of Hippolyta. In the name of all that is good, your wrath upon this world is over.
I remember I was very cynical before this came out, simply because I was cynical of Gal Gadot. And look, she's still not a great actress. I mean, but I give her credit because she worked her tail off to do this. It's clear that she is making a point to do well in this movie. She took acting lessons. She tried to act in this movie, and they worked around some of her, let's just say, shortcomings in acting, with other better actors like, Kylie Nielsen or Robert Wright Penn. And it worked. But I'll tell you, the one thing that really sold me, especially after watching the performance of this film and how well it did, and then looking at some of the special features, I have a lot of respect for her now, more than ever. Mainly because not only did she devote herself to doing this movie, she looks like she's having the time of her life. And that's refreshing to watch. In a day and age where you got stuff like when Daniel Craig is, oh, am I going to do Bond again? I don't know. I'd rather gargle with broken glass. Oh, I guess I will. Pay me $100 billion. When you have that attitude, The fact that you watch Gal Gadot, not just in the movie, but especially in the behind-the-scenes footage that's all over the Blu-ray and DVD, she's giddy as a schoolgirl doing this. And it's clear that she appreciates the job and she appreciates the role and she wants to be the Wonder Woman that everybody wants her to be. Now, in a couple years, will she be like, I'm tired of doing Wonder Woman. I don't want to be typecast. Maybe. I don't know. But at least right now, she's happy as all get out to have the movie and she's happy as all get out to be Wonder Woman. And you know what? That's refreshing. It's refreshing to see that in Hollywood. And now the movie itself, it's a great movie. It's not my favorite superhero movie, but it certainly offers a lot more excitement and optimism more than you saw in the other DC movies. And it's a fun movie. It runs a little long. That's fine. But overall, this feels like a great start to the DC universe. It's like the fourth movie in the process. Now, the special features, my favorite one is there's a little bit with Etta Candy. She has a little bit that leads into the Justice League. And she gets a little mission that she does when she meets with the other guys. There's a whole bunch of behind the scenes stuff that deals with Patty Jenkins. And it also gives the background of Wonder Woman. It's actually somewhat comprehensive. They have an alternate take of No Man's Land and, of course, extended scenes. And the blooper reel is just charming as all get out because she's adorable in this movie. This movie is what made me turn on Gal Gadot and kind of become a fan. So I'm going to have to say that Wonder Woman, the Blu-ray, and the movie itself totally rock.
It rocks.
Excellent!
The other new releases this week include The Big Sick, Bates Motel Season 5, and Arrow Season 5. That is it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about American Made and Flatliners. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.